Well, hi, everybody. It's Stephen Hayward here to launch another one of our episodic Powerline shows. I'd welcome John and Scott and Paul right now, except they're not here. We've gotten to the point where we're about like the Beatles in 1969. It's nearly impossible to get the four of us together in one place, even in the age of the internet and Skype calls. In any case, I want to set the scene for a very special guest with a few observations on where we are at this week. Right now, I'm finishing with final exams, and so I'll have a little bit more time on my hands to resume our electronic media in the weeks ahead and over the summer. In the meantime, if you follow me here on Powerline or last week in the Weekly Standard writing about the crisis at Berkeley, you'll note that I'm following the whole meltdown of universities in real time, almost in front of me. Things aren't so good at universities right now. That's hardly a breaking news story. For a while, we could take the whole scene with a bit of amusement and laugh about safe spaces equipped with cuddly bear plush toys and grief counselors. But suddenly, the safe spaces of universities are not so safe anymore. Universities seem to be slowly, or maybe not so slowly, reverting back to the state they were in the late 1960s and early 1970s with actual violence and bombings and burnings of buildings. So it has gotten to the point now where conservative speakers have to be essentially snuck onto campuses. That was literally the case with Charles Murray at Berkeley a little while ago. I snuck him onto the campus completely unannounced because we feared otherwise there would be a repeat of what happened on February 1st when the riot and violence and arson fire essentially prevented the proposed appearance by Milo Yiannopoulos. In fact, I have a hunch that were it not for that event that got national publicity live on television that night, I'm not sure that the events in Middlebury that occurred to Charles Murray a few weeks later would have happened. I think that explosion at Berkeley is a turning point, like the free speech movement was a turning point way back in 1964, except now it's a turning point in an opposite direction. We're turning back to the violence of the 1960s on campus, and we're turning away from the principles of free speech. Meanwhile, back in Washington, we continue to see the Trump administration grind its gears, trying to decide how to get its story straight on the firing of James Comey. Meanwhile, the Republican Congress is not showing its many signs that it has gotten its act together yet, either on tax reform or on health care. Been a couple of halting steps, and so we'll have to see about all that. But I wonder if there isn't a connection between the corruption of the universities and the corruption of our political process in Washington. And by chance, a few weeks ago, passing through Berkeley, Jonathan Rauch of the Atlantic Monthly and the author of several fine books dropped by, and we had a long, wide-ranging conversation about his latest book called Political Realism. You might even call the book Two Cheers for Corruption in the old-fashioned sense of the word. And so in this our wide-ranging conversation, which I will cue up now, we went across the territory of why government used to work better in the old days when you had a lot more real deal-making, and also the importance of asserting the principle of free speech on college campuses, lest we lose our universities to the maw of a nihilist left that's going to destroy not just free speech, but free inquiry of any kind. Joining me now is Jonathan Rauch, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a contributing editor to the Atlantic Monthly, the author of at least 9 books that he's written or co-written with others, including most recently Political Realism, How Hacks, Machines, Big Money, and Backroom Deals Can Strengthen American Democracy. And Jonathan, welcome. I'll start by noting that the book was written in, or published in 2015. Since then, we have elected a supposed deal maker as our commander-in-chief. And yet the early innings of the Republican majority Congress shows no aptitude for deal-making, for backroom scheming of any kind. I wonder if perhaps they need to read your book to get some clues to how to govern.
Well, it might not hurt. I think I've only written 6 books, but who's counting? Now, I'll take the upgrade to 9. And the most recent one, the full title is Political Realism, How Hacks, Machines, Big Money, and Backroom Deals Can Strengthen American Politics. And what it talks about is politics is not self-organizing. In order to make government work, you need a constitution and all the formal laws and offices, but you also need political machines. And those are favor economies. They take years to build. They're like, you know, Steve, you're going to help me by taking this tough vote, and I'm going to go to your district and campaign for you. I'm going to give you some money. I'm going to give you some pork, and you in turn are going to do that for other people. And that's how we build our networks that get things done. So we've spent the last 40 or 50 years systematically demolishing political machines, pretty much every vestige of them. The last bit was kind of earmarks about 5 years ago. And Trump's problem is he's very naive about politics. He's kind of sociopathic. He thinks it's a one-man game. And, you know, one guy with this charisma and deal-making talent walks into a room and snaps his finger and says, I'm here to make a deal. Well, it's not the individuals who make the deals. It's the machines who make the deals. It's the favor economies. You call in your favors. You say, I'm going to protect you on this vote. You say, what do you need? And then you're in a position to give it to. He can't do any of that. He's not even a Republican, much less a Republican deal maker.
Right. You know, I wonder, let's go through some of the changes that have taken place. Just the heightened scrutiny and transparency in the political world, which on the surface sounds good. On the other hand, I remember reading with great admiration the description of how Lyndon Johnson, as Senate Majority Leader, got the 1957 Civil Rights Act through the Senate. You may remember, if you've read Robert Caro's book about that. How did Johnson do it? Well, he essentially bribed Western Democratic senators from places like Wyoming and Montana with water projects, right? They didn't care about the civil rights legislation that much one way or another, but Johnson said the deal he cut was, I'll give you water projects if you give me your civil rights vote. That kind of deal making today, one, I'm not sure our senators have the facility to make it. And two, I'm not sure that would survive the kind of press scrutiny we have these days with all the behind the scenes reporting that journalists like you often do, right?
Yeah, well, you remember when the health care bill went through, all the bad publicity around the so-called Cornhusker kickback, as if there's something wrong for giving somebody a favor in order to get them to take a tough vote and risk something for you. So it's very hard to pass a debt limit bill, for example, if you can't do favors. All of these reforms that we've made in the last 40 or 50 years, and we can go through them, it's kind of interesting, but all of them were well-intentioned, and transparency is a good example of that. It said, you know, throw open the doors of government, let the people see what's going on, government will be cleaner and more effective. Well, it turns out not to work, because it turns out that in order to do deal-making, you need to have some grown-ups having private conversations behind closed doors. James Madison said that if the Constitutional Convention had been open to the public, they would never have been able to write the Constitution. So transparency has its strong points, but when you go as far as we have today, you can disable or hamper the ability of officials to have candid conversations. What do you need? What can I give you? Trial balloons in private instead of the public posturing that goes on. And there are lots of examples like that of how these well-intentioned reforms and reformers, of whom I was one,
right.
have caused these problems.
Well, we all were when we were younger, right?
Well, at the time, you know, it all looked so easy. We'll just clean up politics. Things will work.
Right. So to revisit that old famous saying about you don't want to see two things made, sausage and legislation, all these reforms have meant that not only do we not get cleaner sausage, but we don't get any sausage at all.
Well, that's right. Possibly, with the possible exception of the drug war or maybe the war in Iraq, the litany of reforms we passed over the last 40 years to politics and government are probably the most comprehensive failure in policymaking. They were supposed to increase confidence in government and reduce corruption and increase the effectiveness of government. Well, in fact, effectiveness of government is much lower than it was before because we've taken away so many of the tools that politicians need to organize their world. Politics, it wasn't actually very corrupt when we started, but people now say it's as corrupt as ever, and they believe it's more corrupt. So confidence in government is also down. So we're kind of 0 for 3 there, and I think need to begin thinking about reconstituting some of the mechanisms that lets politicians be politicians.
So you're thinking of things like, you know, campaign finance reform that has simply distorted and changed how money enters the fray. And
The big ones are campaign finance reform, that's right, which basically made it much harder for politicians and especially political parties to use money as glue, to channel it to friends, to raise it, to use it as it's a way to create political bonds. We made that much more difficult. Another is pork. This is a big conservative bugaboo. Libertarians said, you know, this is corruption, this is crony capitalism, no more pork. Well, they forgot that when you take away congressionally mandated spending, the power flows to the executive branch. So the bureaucrats do it. And then they turned it over to entitlement programs, which are self-operating and just make government bigger. Meanwhile, we took away the ability to give out carrots in Congress. Another, the biggest of all, is when we took away from parties the ability to choose their own nominees. And that's had ramifications all the way up and down the line. But it has gravely weakened the ability of parties to recruit and vet and bring to power people who are team players and know how to govern.
Let's talk a little bit more about earmarks for a moment, because I think I agree with you generally about earmarks. But it seems to me that things got out of hand, and you might say they abused the privilege, right? You may know the numbers about how the number of earmarks just exploded over the last 20-some years until Congress reluctantly put a stop to it. And so is it fair to say that Congress brought this on themselves by not having at least some modicum of self-restraint?
Well, yes and no. Congress brought it on themselves. They got obsessed with earmarks. But here's what people forgot. In 2007, 2008, earmarks were reformed, and they were effectively reformed. So the earmark system that was actually abolished was one that was working quite well. Earmarks at that point were regularized, so they worked like grants. And if you wanted an earmark, you were going to have to apply for it, and then the member was going to have to post it online. It was going to go through the Committee of Jurisdiction. And it actually became quite a merit-based kind of fast action system for members of Congress to direct federal money to local problems. Conservatives ought to like that, right? They sure ought to like that better than some bureaucrat using formulas to dispense zillions of dollars mindlessly. So if we went back to the reformed earmark systems, I think we'd be fine.
So your comment about bureaucrats allocating the money instead of elected legislators responding to the priorities of their own districts and the people reminds me of my case for what I call petty corruption as an organizing principle. So let me lay it out on you and see if it parallels yours or however you want to react to it. What I have in mind is something like Chicago under Mayor Daley, which is always people thought that urban machines like that, you know, too corrupt, too partial to insiders and so forth. And there's much truth to all that. But in the old days, and people say, why would someone want a campaign to be an alderman for a job that pays $10,000 a year, right? In those days, if you wanted a building permit, you wanted your street plowed after a snowstorm, you needed some little favor, you might have to grease the palm of the alderman, and that's bad in the abstract. On the other hand, what have we replaced it with? Now we've replaced it with a bureaucratic process that often takes much longer, can be arbitrary in practice, and is often more expensive, right? I mean, see what it costs to get a building permit in Chicago now and all the stated fees. And so it's not clear to me
that your lawyers instead of your politicians.
Exactly, paying your lawyers instead of your politicians. It's not clear to me that the reforms of the big urban machines have improved urban governance that much.
Well, and it's not just an urban question. My reaction to that, though, Steve, is amen, brother. The model I've looked at is, you've heard of George Washington Plunkett? Does that name ring a bell?
Oh, yes.
So for those of our listeners who haven't heard of him, Plunkett was a Tammany Hall functionary in the great New York machine of about 100 years ago. He was famous in his day for, and still famous for, the unique distinction of drawing four government paychecks from three government jobs simultaneously. And he had a theory which he set forth, and he would hold forth on politics in the steps of the New York County Courthouse. And a reporter took it down, became a wonderful, famous book called Plunkett of Tammany Hall. He had a theory called honest graft.
Yeah.
So dishonest graft is when Steve Hayward just robs the till, puts it in his pocket, and spends it. Honest graft is when Steve basically pays off another politician or does something that helps the party or the machine get stuff done. Is it corrupt? Yeah. Is it necessary? Yeah. And Plunkett was a real defender of this. He said, if you want party government, you've got to have patronage jobs. You've got to have pork barrel spending. If you take that away from me, I can't run this city. Turns out he was right.
Right. My other example is from more modern times is Robert Moses, who, if he were, I don't know if you've ever read Carroll's biography of him, but if he were around today doing the kinds of things he did back then, he would be arrested immediately.
Well, and as would LBJ, and right. You know, for that matter, people forget the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. Very difficult to pass. The only way to get it through was to get some Republican support. The Southern Democrats were blocking it. So LBJ calls up Charles Halleck, who's the minority leader, in the Senate and says, what do you need? And Halleck says, well, you know, this is a really tough one, but there's a research grant for Purdue University to study space. And LBJ supposedly said, you know, Chuck, I cannot think of a better place on this planet to put a research facility for outer space than in West Lafayette, Indiana. So he got his earmark and that civil rights bill passed.
Those were better times.
Yeah, well, that system had its flaws, too. I don't want people to come away thinking there is a golden glow of perfection about any of this. Governing is messy. It's difficult. But you've got to allow some degree of political freedom for politicians to organize and do the stuff they need to do. You can't be too prudish about it.
Well, speaking of political freedom, let's shift gears a little bit to another one of your older books that rings even more relevant today, and it's Kindly Inquisitors.
Before we shift to that book,
sure.
Can I do a little advertisement?
Absolutely.
I'd just like everyone reading, listening to this podcast to know that you can download my free ebook, Political Realism. It's completely free. It's very short. It's on the Brookings website. It's on Amazon.com. Just Google Rausch Political Realism. It'll come right up totally free, and it's a really quick read.
I will second that motion right away. But I think people might also want to go back and read Kindly Inquisitors, which was published when? Was that the late 90s? Or?
It was first published in 92. It's now 92, out in right. A revised, updated edition that was
right.
Published in 2013.
Right. The subtitle, I think, is important. The New Attacks on Free Thought. Was that the original subtitle or the revised one?
That's both.
Both titles.
Yep.
So what has changed? Let's start this way. What has changed between the first edition and now? Things are getting worse, or are there new dimensions to this problem? Go ahead and give it your opening shot.
Well, let's start. Can we start with what hasn't changed?
Sure.
Just some big picture stuff. So the first thing to remember is that free speech advocates, of which I am for my whole life, it's never going to be easy. We're going to have to wake up every morning and defend this principle from scratch every day for the rest of our lives because it's so counterintuitive. How can it be okay for society or for individuals to allow people to say things that are mean and vicious and harmful and wrongheaded and antisocial? Yet it turns out that that principle is incredibly effective. So that hasn't changed. Another thing that hasn't changed is the idea that I wrote that book about originally, that words can wound. So words are like bullets. So saying harmful things to people is a form of violence. Well, if it's a form of violence, you've got to regulate it. It's a rights violation. You've got to get rid of it. And I argued very strongly in that book and continue to argue it's a crucial distinction to understand that, no, bullets will kill you whether you want them to or not. But words are a transaction. And it's very important that we remember not to just assume that words have this magical power, you know, the so-called N-word. Or whatever, but people are using this analogy between words and violence to censor. That hasn't gone away. Some things that are new is the bureaucratization of speech controls on campus. This was an ideological movement in the early 90s coming from kind of the far left. Those people sort of lost the argument. There wasn't really that much support, but then along came Title IX and Title VII and all these bureaucracies and administration guidance and the hostile environment rule. And campuses set up all these offices to prevent discriminatory verbal harassment, as it was called. So now we've got this kind of very different, much less ideological, but in some ways more insidious network of enforcers of free speech on campuses. So it's kind of a different battle now. You're kind of going up against bureaucracy. As you know, in some ways, that's tougher. And then you've got the safe space movement, the trigger warning movement. Those are based on old ideas, which is that antisocial ideas hurt individuals and hurt society and are oppressive. Nothing new about that. But that's been internalized by a lot of students lately. So that's also kind of, I think, a new challenge.
Yeah, let me go back to the very beginning of your statement.
I filibustered.
No, that's fine. That was all very good. Let me put it this way. It sounds like you don't rule out the idea that hate speech is an intelligible idea and that you can even, take the famous Supreme Court case of Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire from the 40s about fighting words, that words can constitute an assault. We've lost the ability to make a distinction between speech that is intended as an assault, like the N-word, and speech that is merely offensive because it's controversial.
Well, I'm not sure I'm a big believer in that distinction. You know, if you read Huckleberry Finn, you'll see the the N-word, as we now call it. I hate using that expression because it gives these words control over us when we should be controlling them. But anyway, you'll see the word consistently throughout it. And you hear it in the black community. If you went to see this year's Academy Award-winning best film, it's just full of that word. So I believe it's all contextual, and I think by setting up these separate categories like hate speech, what we're really doing is trying to say, well, what offends me is some larger national problem, some abstract problem. But I also try to make the point that we need to remember hate speech is good for us, especially minorities. It's not fun, but it flushes out the other team. It forces and puts their cards on the table. It allows us to compare ourselves with them, know where they are, to confront them with better ideas. That's how we gay people won the gay marriage debate. It's how we gained acceptance in society. It was not by silencing the hate speech against us. And it was hate speech by any reasonable colloquial definition. You know, we were stench in the nostril of God. We deserved to die and so forth.
Right.
We won that argument with our voices, with free speech. So it is perverse for minorities to try to say that suppression of speech, censorship, which always winds up being a tool to impose conformity by majorities, helps minorities.
I think, well, let's actually talk about your personal story a little bit to the extent you want to, but especially, I think you wrote one of the first books advocating in favor of gay marriage. What was it, 2003, I think?
2004, very
2004,
good.
Gay marriage, why it is good for gays, good for straights, and good for America. It wasn't just an argument about equal protection clause and claiming equality. You're making a positive case that this is a good idea, right? I mean, I've forgotten the argument now because I read it at the time. But
really, yeah, it was a social conservative argument for,
right, that's
for same-sex marriage. And it said all the reasons society wants straight people to get married are the same reasons they want gay people to get married.
Right, right. Go back to the free speech on campus and elsewhere. What are some of the remedies for this? What reforms do you think should be advocated by those of us who are
It's a good question, and one I'd like to ask you and a lot of other people, because I think over the last 20 years, free speech advocates have done pretty well on the supply side of speech codes. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, among others, has shown people that it is possible to fight back. The number of so-called green light schools that are good on free speech, has increased. There's still plenty of problems with campus censorship, but people have done a pretty good job of dealing with the supply side. The demand side, everyone tells me on campus that there's been no progress there, that the demand from students and also from faculty, but especially from students to be protected from speech they don't like is as great or greater than ever. In fact, people tell me that, whereas in the 90s when I first started writing about this, most of the demand for speech code was coming from faculty. These were often left-wing people who kind of wanted to control the agenda. Now I'm hearing most of the demand is coming from students, often opposed by faculty. But students are saying, this is our home. We pay a lot of money to be here. We've been protected our whole lives until now. It's your job to protect us. And that's new. I don't know what you do about that, and I'm trying to figure that out and talking to folks on campuses to understand that better.
Right, right. So we're here at Berkeley today, where 6 weeks ago we saw essentially a riot to prevent Milo Yiannopoulos from talking. Ann Coulter is coming later this month. We'll see how that goes. They're both intentionally provocative. Are they helpful to this cause, or is it a neutral factor, or what do you think about having Milo come talk?
I think it's fine for Milo to come talk. I think it's an act of strategic malfeasance for people who oppose Milo to decide to wage riots. His business model is to provoke. And every time he succeeds in that, his speaking fees go up and his book advances go up and he gets more famous and he gets to be the darling of the politically incorrect right. And I would point out to your listeners who are not members of the politically incorrect right that there is a name for this business model. It's called trolling. And I'd also point out to them that someone just trolled his way all the way to the White House. And part of the reason he did that was by taking advantage of a backlash against political correctness, very consciously, quite explicitly. So these people who are out there rioting and making Ann Coulter, Milo Yiannopoulos, rich or president, are doing themselves absolutely no favors. The first thing I'd say to them is, okay, if only on tactical grounds, cut it out. You're making the other side stronger. And that's before we get to the fundamental arguments about why it's worthwhile to hear what even obnoxious people have to say.
Yeah, I will say in defense of some people on the left here at Berkeley that I know, that the day after the Milo riots, I was here for all that. The day after it, there were a couple of people from the local communist bookstore, some old fossils from the 60s who hang around, trying to defend what had happened. And they were surrounded by a fairly energetic, borderline angry, it wasn't a mob, it was perfectly peaceful, but they were angry students and some older people who were all saying, what a blunder to have done what you guys did. Don't you realize that violence helps Trump? So there are at least some people aligned on the left who get this.
I think a lot of people do. One of the things I pick up when I talk to students is there's this kind of silent majority out there. They're not on board with censorship. They're not on board with silencing. On the other hand, they're not going to be people who join the ACLU or Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And part of what we need to do is give those people their voices. And another thing we need to do is get people to be a little bit smarter about what's going on. One of the things that I heard, maybe you could clarify, was that a lot of the people who protested against Yiannopoulos were, in fact, not members of the Berkeley University community. Is that right? They were outsiders?
Yes, I think that's quite true. I was actually watching them infiltrate with their black masks on and, with pipes, and it was clear that bad things were going to happen. However, I'd say this, an awful lot of the students who'd assembled an hour before to protest through bullhorns and, spout some of the usual cliches on the hate speech from Milo, then cheered on the fire that was started and the windows that were being broken. So I think it's a mixed bag there. But, yeah, the trouble came mostly from the physical violence came mostly from off-campus agitators.
But it was supported by campus factions?
Yeah, I think so.
Was it opposed by campus factions?
Well, I left immediately because I didn't want to be around. I didn't want to get my head cracked, right? So that's hard to know exactly. It was a confused scene. So.
Well, and then we had the Middlebury incident, which I think drew national attention. A lot of people are scratching their heads about how things got this bad. This is Charles Murray, who is a conservative scholar, former colleague of yours at AEI, American Enterprise Institute, wrote a very controversial book that touched on race and intelligence, went to Middlebury to speak on a very different book, actually, an anti-inequality book that the left ought to love or like. And there was a protest in which he was silenced by a group of students that had almost the feeling of a ritual incantation, a kind of mass exorcism. It was really creepy. They wouldn't let him speak. And then when he retreated to a private room to do a podcast, as he left from that event, he and the professor who hosted him were violently mobbed, and she was injured. She wound up in the hospital. And I think people are really shaken by that. Even people who have not been particularly mobilized on this issue. When a place like Middlebury, an American liberal arts college, right in the mainstream of our academic tradition, behaves this way, and these were students, these were not outsiders, then that's all the lights on the dashboard flashing red.
Yeah, one of the bitter ironies of that whole business is that one of Charles's own daughters went to Middlebury about 10 years ago. And so for him to be treated that way is especially sad. Let me give you a last question. One of the things I've always liked about you is your sort of flinty realism. You take the insights of, public choice theory and, you might say Madisonian realism about how government works, how society works, and you do wonderful extensions of that in journalism for a wider audience. So I guess what I'm wanting to ask is are you optimistic? How do you keep from being a pessimist or a cynic? I mean, right? I mean, what's
really,
your outlook?
Remember what Lily Tomlin said, I try to be cynical, but it's so hard to keep up.
Right.
I'm a long-term optimist because the American experiment, the most daring and the most creative and the most vibrant and successful experiment in social organization ever, has worked out well, despite times which have been much harder than what we're going through. In the short term, I'm not so optimistic. I'm worried and frightened by the ascent of Donald Trump, a figure who has a lot in common with European-style populist authoritarians. We're seeing that trend around the world. We've seen the dismantling of a lot of the mediating institutions, like political parties, for example, and unions and civic organizations and mainline religions. which gave people voices, allowed them to channel their feelings in productive ways. We've dismantled a lot of those, and that's caused a lot of frustration and enemy. So in the short run, I'm not as certain I know how to get to the long run.
Yeah, something you said prompted a follow-up, one more, or maybe more than one. You know, I remember when I was younger how you talk about religious institutions once being prominent as a mediating institution. I remember there was a period, you may remember too, you're not as old as I am, but it seemed like every time there was some public controversy, you might have a public commission, you might not, but somewhere in that you would hear from Father Theodore Hesburgh, the president of Notre Dame, right? He was just a significant private citizen figure. And I can't think of anybody like him out on the scene right now, right? We don't, and I don't, you know, I don't know why, you know, what accounts for that or how to explain it, but that seems to me fits with your thesis.
Yeah, to an extent, though. I try to get people to focus less on the individual wise men and women and more on the importance of the institutions, which really are the key social connectors. I have a husband who worked in the low-wage service workforce for a while last year and saw firsthand how today's service economy workers have no voice. It's not just a question of their wages haven't gone up in 15 years. That's another problem. But it's also that, you know, they do stuff like just-in-time scheduling. You have no way to plan your life. They don't care, and there's no one to talk to. There's no union. There's no workers' organization. That's how it is. So you feel like you don't have any agency or control or even in some cases dignity. And what institutions do, parties, for example, you can show up and maybe you're licking envelopes, but you feel like you're playing a role in politics. Unions can give workers voice. Mainline religions, people like Hesburgh, but these big institutions, people could plug into them. And that's a lesson that we baby boomers, alas, that's you and me, Steve.
Right.
We tended to forget that. We thought it was all about individual freedom to the maximum all the time. Well, we were wrong about that.
Well, Jonathan, on that realistic note, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.